Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with another installment of Christogenos. And we're going to be discussing part 7 of the two seed line message. And we've gone through Genesis chapters 1-4 and discussed the fact that Genesis 3:15, which is the main verse, probably the very first prophecy in all of Scripture, which talks about the fact that there will be an enmity or hatred or antagonism between two different, seed lines is the best word. I can't think of a better word. Can you, Bill?
Absolutely not. It's definitely two different seed lines.
Uh-huh.
No, I mean two different families of people.
Right.
But that really isn't apt enough a description.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's those two groups, original groups, have broken into many different peoples by now.
Right, certainly.
It's actually two set opposing groups of peoples and nations.
Yes.
And quite often they found living together.
Right, and we shouldn't be living together.
Right, but they're living together in all of the nations, all the southern nations of Europe, and there's sprinklings of the seed line of the serpent throughout the northern nations, and there's a good portion of them here in America.
Yes. And I think last week, it may have been the week before, we talked about the fact that some readers and commentators of the book of Genesis and the Bible in general failed to see the connection between Genesis 3:15 and subsequent history.
Right. And we also pointed out last week, and this is very important, and this is important because all of these people, these doubters, this Stephanie Jones and Ted Wieland,
mm-hmm.
they claim that we hang our biblical beliefs on a single scripture, Genesis 3:15.
Right.
And we made it clear that Cain has the birthright inheritance.
Right.
Cain was told that he would rule over Abel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Seth is a replacement for Abel.
Yes.
In the New Testament, we find that the adversary, or the Satan, or the devil, or however you want to term it, that term applies to a collective group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually called the assembly of the adversary in Revelations 2:9 and 3:9.
Right.
Where we see that they are a collection of people.
That's right.
That these people claim to be rulers of the world in Luke chapter 4, verses 5 to 7.
Well, that claim is actually accurate, isn't it?
Yes, that claim is very accurate.
Yes.
They're called, throughout the New Testament, they're called the princes of this world and many other similar epithets.
Yes.
And they rule the world.
Yes.
And today we see, and all through history we have seen, this same group of people who we know today as Jews.
Yes.
In the shadows, lurking in the shadows, running our governments, running our economies.
Yes.
They're the princes of this world. There is no
yes.
doubt. And that goes back to the statement by Yahweh to Cain that he would rule over Abel.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequently over Seth, because
right.
Seth is only a replacement for Abel.
Yes, yes.
Now, this is absolutely clear. And Yahshua Christ himself, addressing the Edomite Pharisees and Sadducees, he explains to them that they're the descendants of Cain.
Mm-hmm.
That's in Luke chapter 11, verses 49 through 51.
Yes.
They are the physical, literal descendants of Cain and the children of the devil.
Yes.
John 8:44 and 1 John 3:12.
Yes.
There is no doubt that two seed line is the context of the entire scripture.
Right. Yeah.
And it's the anti-seed liners who hang their opposition on one verse, Genesis 4:1,
yes.
which is demonstrably corrupt.
Right. And doesn't mean what they think it means.
Right. And the anti-seed liners, most of them recognize, like you said yourself, that we have what Adolf Hitler called a Jewish problem.
Right.
And
exactly.
We have a very small fanatical religious minority who sneaks into every Western nation and corrupts its governments.
That's right.
And overturns them and twists twists and contorts everything that they're originally about.
Yeah, you can I still look at America today and all the Jewish tax dodgers that Obama has pointed as cabinet officers.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And right, the laws apply to everybody except them. And
that's right.
It's right in the Talmud that's the way that they feel. That's their religious conviction.
Yes. Okay, we have Central California on the line.
I'm here.
Hello. Oh, Pastor Advari.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for calling in. Yeah, feel free to, you know, have a comment or question as we proceed tonight, okay?
You sure?
All right, yeah. So
I'm just standing by.
Okay, great. All right. And so, you know, what we understand, and you and I and, you know, Pastor Advari and all of the seedliners, such as Bertrand Comparay and Dr. Wesley Swift and many, many others, is that the Jewish people are the descendants of the various seed lines, which are actually documented in Scripture, going all the way back to Cain, who is definitely the son of Eve. There's no doubt about that. Genesis chapter 3 definitely states that Cain is the son of Eve. But the issue is whether or not he is the son of Adam. And what we have been pointing out is that he is absolutely not the son of Adam, and he had a different father.
Absolutely, and, yeah. And we're on the verge of presenting a great cloud of witnesses to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Satan rules the world. It's clear as a bell. And,
that's right.
And the enmity between the two seed lines has carried down all through history.
That's right.
Through ancient history in the Bible, we can see it in Rome, and there are a lot of things that are little documented. For instance, I have documentation in Strabo that one of the Caesars had a teacher that was a Canaanite.
Right.
A hired tutor that was a Canaanite.
Mm-hmm.
It's spelled out right in Strabo.
Right, right.
There are a lot of nuances in history and things in history that aren't readily recognizable unless you know this message.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And unless you accept it. And once you accept it, then the picture, you only have a sketch, but once you accept this message, the entire picture of history begins to fill itself in.
Yeah, another great example is in the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. I forget that's the exact title, by Gibbon, I believe.
Yeah.
And he states very clearly that it was the Jewess Poppaea. She was actually a converted Jewess who had begun doing the work of the Jewish moneylenders behind the scenes. And she was actually instrumental in instituting the persecutions against Christians.
Right. She was persuaded to do that by her countrymen.
That's right.
And that is also supported by Tertullian, the early bishop of Carthage, when Carthage was a great white nation.
Yes.
And Tertullian, the bishop, said that it was the Jews who put the Romans up to the persecutions.
All right. So while Nero was fiddling, his wife Poppaea was actually doing the conniving.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And doing the because obviously it was the antagonism, even those days, in the early days of Christianity, the antagonism of the Jews towards Christians was unbelievable. Okay. And one of the reasons why the Jews composed the Masoretic text was because the Christians were using the Septuagint as their source of scripture for the Old Testament, and the Jews were unable to disprove from the Septuagint that Jesus Christ was in fact the Messiah. Okay.
Right, but they only really disproved it in their own polluted minds because they're hooked on that Kabbalic numerology.
That's right. Yes, yes. And so what they did was they created a redacted form of the Hebrew Scriptures called the Masoretic Text. And in that text, as you are well aware, they reduced the number of years of the days from Adam down to Messiah by 1,000 years.
It's more like 1,400, I think.
Okay. Well, whatever the number is, their intent was to try to disprove that Jesus Christ was the Messiah.
Yes, and I have notes on it, but I haven't compiled them yet.
Yes.
There are actually many clear messianic prophecies in the Septuagint, and there are a lot of clear messianic prophecies in the King James.
Oh, there's hundreds.
That I think remain because the Jews didn't understand them.
That's right.
However, there are even more and clearer ones in the Septuagint that have been removed from the King James.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's one of the great, in fact, the early church fathers clearly state that one of the reasons that the Jewish Masoretes composed the Masoretic text was exactly for that purpose, to try to, you know, lessen the impact of the Messianic prophecies having to do with Yahshua Messiah, and among other things. They had so the early church fathers were fully aware of the machinations of these people called the Jews, okay? And our people today are still relatively unaware of these machinations and what's going on behind the scenes and how they have altered the scriptures to suit their own interpretations and confuse and befuddle and deceive typical Christians.
Yes, and it's evident that this was being done not only in the Christian period, but also at the dawn of what we might want to call the Edomite period in Judea.
Okay.
Or maybe even before that. I mean, Jeremiah 8:8. Jeremiah testifies that the Kenite scribes had changed the word into a lie. It changed the law into a lie.
Right, right.
And we see in Chronicles that the scribes are the Kenites in Judea.
Yes.
And that's a natural occupation for them now.
Right.
And to be a lawyer and
exactly.
a scribe.
A lawyer.
And it's a natural occupation for them 3,000 years ago. That's what they did.
Yes. Lawyers, money changers, scribes, bankers. In fact, one of the definitions of the word Canaanite is trafficker and peddler and merchant.
Yes, it is.
And that's exactly what the Jews are today.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes.
And that's they have fit their natural. I mean, we all have our inbred abilities,
special talents. Yes.
Yeah, special talents, and that's what they do.
Uh-huh. Okay, before we get into Chapter 5, I have a list of, because last time we talked about the importance of names and that lacking other information, just given the name of a particular person in Scripture, gives us some interesting information about the person. Okay, for example, Abel. Word number 1893 in the Hebrew means transitory or unsatisfactory, which is very interesting in light of two seed line, because certainly Abel was transitory due to the fact that he was murdered by Cain and therefore could not have offspring. But the connotation of unsatisfactory is very interesting in the light of two seed line, because if he indeed shared the womb with Cain, you know, as they were commonly called fraternal twins, not identical twins, then it's certainly conceivable that Abel was infected by the infection that was brought about by the seed of Nahash, okay, and therefore was not acceptable as certainly not as an Adamite in the sense of the immortal bodies that we were supposed to have. Something happened inside the womb of Eve that made Abel, therefore, unsatisfactory.
I'm going to say that I'm not really sure where you're getting that definition from.
Okay.
Or where your source gets that definition from. I could see the connection between something transient and the word meaning in its most basic form. It says, Strong says that it comes from a word that means breath.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a sign of transience.
Yes.
But I can't understand the unsatisfactory
part,
to be honest, because Abel is considered righteous, and
oh, yes.
His blood was righteous.
Okay.
Abel's blood, the righteous blood, is described as righteous in the New Testament. So there's no doubt to me that Abel wasn't a righteous man.
Yes.
The genetics of Adam and Eve, put it that way.
I might have gotten this from Cruden's. I don't have the exact listing here. I just noted these names down quickly. Seth.
I can agree that a breath is something that's transient.
Okay.
However, I don't think that he's named after that for that reason, but that's, you know, that's a matter that's subjective.
Yes, and I think that you mentioned last week that the name Cain is derived from the word lance or spear.
Yes, it's the same exact word as a word, as a noun with the same form used as a noun that means lance or spear.
Yes.
Even though it can be taken from a certain verb, canna, which which can mean to get or acquire.
Right.
And the connection is quaint and more than likely means something.
Right.
Well, quite often in the ancient world, things were acquired by the spear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's called a stick-up.
Yeah, well.
And Esau was known as a highwayman as well.
And he
made his common cause with these Canaanites.
Well, the Edomites were natural highwaymen because Petra was a sort of a rock, a natural rock fortress
mm-hmm.
that was enclosed on all four sides practically, had a very narrow opening at one end that you could get in and out. It was very easy to defend.
Yes.
Because it was in like a long canyon between these huge rocks.
It was a hideout.
Yes, and it was a hideout, but it was also a hideout that was right off the main caravan routes between Arabia, Egypt, and Mesopotamia.
Yes.
So it was an ideal hideout.
Yes. So for highwaymen, it was an ideal place to launch their robberies from. They were like land pirates is probably a good way of putting it.
Yes.
Yeah, and took advantage of the caravans that went back and forth along the trade routes. Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the name Seth means substitute or alternatively to place or appoint. Okay. And of course, let me go back to Genesis 4:25, and Adam knew his wife again, and she bare a son and called his name Seth, for God said she hath appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew. So this is Eve's own words, and Adam and Eve named Seth because he is the replacement for Abel. And in verse 26, and to Seth, to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. Then began men to call upon the name of Yahweh. So Enos means a mortal man in the general sense. So very interesting that, of course, there's two senses of the word Adam in concordances. I believe 119 is the original sense, which simply means to show blood in the face. And I believe 120 is the sense which means fallen. And
well, I can protest that just on the grounds that in Paleo Hebrew, there's no distinction between these words.
Okay. All right. So I mean,
one word can mean many different things. Don't get me wrong. But there's no real distinction between them in Paleo Hebrew.
Okay.
Today's lexicographers separate these words and make distinguishments of them as they move through Scripture to see how they're used. And that's subjective also.
Right, certainly.
And open to interpretation.
Yes.
And they assign the different usages to one or the other just to make it easier for the student to discern the meanings and see how they're used and where. But basically, in Paleo Hebrew language, there's no distinction between them.
Okay.
And it's just like a lot of English words like pair, P-A-R-E and P-E-A-R and
right.
P-A-I-R. It's the same sound.
Right.
And if we take the vowels out, they're all spelled P-R.
Right.
And it's up to the context to see how they're, determine how they're used.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Switching over now to the Kenite seed line, which we discussed last week. Enoch from Genesis 4:17 means initiated. Very interesting. Like initiated into a secret society. Irad, Genesis 4:18 means fugitive. And a variant, Arad, to sequester or hide out. We just discussed one of their hideouts.
Yes.
So Arad means fugitive. Mehujael, Genesis 4:18, Strong's number 4232, means smitten of God. Derived from another word, 4229, which means to erase.
Well, that's fitting.
Yes. Okay, Methuselah. Man who is of God, an adult, or an extended lifetime. Then I don't know how many years he lived. But, of course, in this God, from God, if God is translated from the Hebrew El, stemming from Elohim, it doesn't necessarily mean Yahweh.
Well, yeah, it could be any God.
Right. It could be one of the fallen El that we'll be discussing in chapter 6. Okay. And then Lamech, and has this uncertain meaning, but seems to be cognate with the word lame in English. Okay, so that's the, oh yeah, and here we have Jabal, to flow, course, stream, or alternatively to have running sores. Okay, and then Jubo is also a stream or river, and of course here probably what stream and river mean, as they mean in prophecy and in the book of Revelation, is a stream or river of descendants. That Jabal and Jubo and for example, Tubal Cain, which simply means offspring of Cain. It also means intelligence, argument, wise, and skillful, and certainly to be a good deceiver. You have to have all of those. So you have to be a good rabbi.
Right, and they have, there's no doubt they have wisdom, but it's always a crafty, hollow
That's
sort
right.
of wisdom.
That's right, and that goes back to their father Nachash, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Who is that crafty, wise, conniving one.
Okay. Right, and it's definitely cognate. It's within the race. It's,
yes.
It's genealogical. It's no doubt.
Yes, and the word Kenite is simply a descendant of Cain. Canaanite, as I mentioned earlier, is peddler, merchant, or trafficker. And his son, Canaan, the name of Canaan, which we'll probably get to later in Genesis 6 as well, means humiliated. Also means merchant and traffic, okay? So it shows there's a cognate relationship between Cain and the man and Canaanites, the people. So there's all kinds of associations that come to mind. I guess it's kind of a Rorschach test of of the meanings of names that we can get into and find, you know, get some meaningful information just from the names of these people. Okay, so let's continue now with Genesis chapter 5, verse 1. This book.
Before we get into a big news subject, can I say something?
Sure.
You know, the Concordance is a wonderful book. Mr. Strong's really did a beautiful job in the days that no computer existed.
Yes.
And it's amazing how he was managing
yes.
to get all these things fairly clear.
I can see him buried under a pile of notes.
But when you go to the couple of words, Adam and the word Kenites,
yes.
it really made a big issue for me when I was studying
okay.
the first time. And I noticed that a lot of people don't understand who the Kenites are, so we tell them.
Right.
And what few people would mention is that the word Kenite is in the Bible since Numbers, Judges, including Genesis 15:19, and then Judges and Simon.
Oh yeah, it's
yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
definitely planning on illustrating that.
Right.
Yeah, and here's the thing: the number assigned to it by Strong is 7014.
Okay.
Okay, and pardon me.
Which is Cain.
Yeah, and that's what nobody noticed.
Oh, right,
it should
it's the same
be,
word.
It should be Cain, Cayenne, Cainites, and all that stuff. So that's
right.
obvious that the same person.
Yes.
And the Kenites are Cain's seed.
That's right.
And they were way before, these new explanations of the original
Right.
You know, originality of people and Israelites and so on.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the Canaanites, or the Kenites, more correctly called, because the Canaanites.
Yeah, Kenites.
Yeah, the Kenites, because the Canaanites are actually derived from the name of Canaan, but they're still the same people, because Canaan, all Canaan did was he married into the race of Kenites, and they assumed his name or his history has given the Kenites the name Canaanites ever since. Okay.
Yeah.
But they're still the same people.
The other thing I just going to mention is this word 120
okay.
Under, Adam.
Yes.
And you can find about 8 or 10 different names where come from the 120. And what bothers me the most is that, first of all, the concordance is not a Bible. It's just a...
tool, like a dictionary,
working
yes.
for the Bible. But what bothers me most that people don't understand that one of the words for Adam was Lord, I mean God, and Satan. And so here is the word, and I just lost the thing on my big excitement here.
All right. I'm not sure what you mean. One of the definitions of the word Adam is Lord or Satan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, not, wait a minute.
I'm not
Baal.
Familiar with that.
Baal is Lord.
Baal.
Yeah.
Okay.
And let's see, from 160.
Right. Baal is Lord, yes.
165 all the way down to 1188. The relations, there's about 20 numbers here,
okay.
which all originated from the word Baal.
Okay.
And on the word Adam, it bothers me because it's 120. People say, well, that has to be the creation that has to be of Adam, you know. Well, the first chapter of Genesis is also 120.
Yes.
But I don't understand why Mr. Strong's couldn't find another number out of all the billions of numbers we have, so that hang that on Adam and hang on the other one on what the heck?
What, Baal?
Baal. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I'm not sure what you're getting at. Obviously, the Adamites are only mentioned in Genesis chapter 1. I think it's verses 26 and 27. And those are the people to whom dominion is given to. But we understand here on this show, we've been presenting the argument that the other races were already here on the earth. That's also proved in Genesis chapter 1.
Yeah, okay. I find a note here.
Yes.
It's
okay.
113.
113.
It says Adam.
Yes.
And Adam. And then it goes to say an unused root. The sovereign, controller, divine, and it says Lord,
yes,
master,
well, that's Adon,
owner.
Oh, okay.
And this is for Adam.
Okay, let Bill comment on this now. I think he understands what you're talking
Adon,
about.
Adon, the word Adon, I don't have my concordance. It's on the other side of the room.
Yes.
Adon means Lord, A-D-O-N.
Yes.
And that is may follow Adam.
Right.
In the book, the M words, but that's a DN word. It's a different word.
Right. Okay. Oh, now I understand what you're getting at, Pastor Dvari. Yeah, so the Adon, A-D-O-N, is actually the root word for the Hebrew Adonai.
Yeah.
Adonai,
yeah.
Which is Lord.
But people use it for Adam.
Oh,
well,
okay.
That's their confusion.
That's
but it
right.
doesn't mean Adam. That's A-D-A-M.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's,
and they
in
tell
Hebrew,
me.
That's Aleph and Daleth
yes.
before the M. And not N.
Right, right.
And even though they're in that order in Hebrew that they are in English, they're two different words.
Right, right.
And
people,
Adam means ruddy and
rosy.
Yes.
And rosy. And that's because if you look at Strong's number 1818, and Strong doesn't mention this, the word Dam, D-A-M, means blood.
Yes. Adam means
yeah.
show blood in the face. Yes.
And
yeah.
the low, you know, man... Low degree man and persons, and Adam is same as 120, and this is what I'm telling you. From here on, 121, 123, 27, 130, they all have the word Adam somehow
right.
in it.
Okay.
Right, but you get to a certain point that M changes to an N,
right.
and the word becomes Adon,
yes.
as in Adonai,
right.
and that word means Lord.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's not the same word as Adam.
Right.
No.
Yes. Right, exactly, yeah. But there's certainly a lot of confusion about that. And the and you mentioned the definition, I think it's either 120 or 119, where it refers to fallen man. Well, it's conceivable that Adam is used
well,
in that
when
sense.
I talk to people...
I have to make a defense of that, and that's that people don't know how to read the Strong's Concordance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There is, in every Strong's definition, at the beginning of the definition... that there are words that are not in italics, and they are explanatory words showing the parts of speech.
Okay.
And there are words in italics. Those italicized words at the beginning of the Strong's definition, they are the definition.
Okay.
And
yeah.
then there's a symbol, and it's a colon with a dash. And everything after the colon and the dash is not a part of the definition of the word. Everything after the colon, if you read the plan of the book at the beginning of the lexicon, it explains this. Everything after the colon and the dash is simply how the King James translators translated the word.
Yes,
and Strong's lists those, but they are not a part of the definition. They're only what the King James translators thought they should translate the word as, and quite often they're dead wrong.
Right, and their usages employed in the King James, not necessarily definitions. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
It's only the front part of the Strong's definition with the words in italics that are the actual Strong's Hebrew definition for the word.
Yeah, and this is actually a very important subject because the word Adonai is the word used by the Masoretes. Guess 9 says Adonai is what the Jews call their God. The Masoretes, what they did, because the word Yahweh, which has been substituted by the word Lord or Baal, as I think this is what Pastor Advari is getting at, they have substituted the word Baal for the word Yahweh close to 8,000 times in the Masoretic text. Okay.
Right, but we have to be careful not to confound Adon and Adam.
Exactly. What they did was they took the vowels of the word Adonai and inserted those in between the consonants of the Hebrew Yahweh, the YHWH, therefore creating the word Jehovah. Okay.
Yeah, actually, it was later scribes that read that as Jehovah.
Right, right.
And read the rabbinical Hebrew errantly.
Yes. And so what the Masoretes did was they simply inserted, they converted the word Yahweh into, subliminally into the word Adonai to suit themselves. Okay. And then they prohibited people from pronouncing the word Yahweh. Okay.
Yeah, well, the Jews pervert things.
That's right.
Do.
It's a total perversion.
Yes.
Yes, it's a total perversion.
Josephus explains to us that the holy name of God that he wouldn't utter because he was a Pharisee and he was trained as a Pharisee and they were taught not that it was an inutterable word. It was not
lawful
to be uttered.
Yes.
Now, he explains to us that the word is pronounced with four vowels.
Okay.
And that's in Antiquities. And a lot of people make the error that would insist that the YHVH or the Yad He Vav He in Hebrew are vowels. But Josephus didn't write that in Hebrew.
Yeah, he
wrote it in Greek.
Right, right.
And the only way you could make that four vowels and make that sound Yahweh is iota, omicron, upsilon, which is I-O, U, and then either an alpha or an eta.
Okay.
Okay, one or the other.
Yahweh,
in other words. Yahweh or Yahweh.
Exactly. Yes.
And I would argue for the eta, but it might even be an epsilon.
Okay.
Okay? Because we're not really sure how the Greeks pronounce their vowel.
Right, right.
All
and
right?
We're not sure how the Hebrews pronounce it either.
Now, if you have iota, I, omicron, O, upsilon, U, epsilon, E, you have Jove.
Yes, exactly.
You have the exact spelled equivalent of the Roman Jove.
Yes, right. And they probably pronounced it Yove, not Jove.
Well, there is great contention that the Latin Z was pronounced like a W.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of evidence that is so, that Caesar, when he crossed the Rubicon, really didn't say Veni, Vidi, Vici.
Right.
He said Waini, Weedy, Weechi.
Okay.
And
right.
That would make Jove Yahweh.
That's right. It's Yahweh in Greek.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, in Latin.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, well, in Greek and Latin.
Without a doubt.
Yes. Yeah. And people don't realize that because the pronunciations have changed over the centuries.
Well,
and people, you're absolutely right. Jove is Yahweh.
And the theologians and all the clowns in academia deny it.
That's right. Yes, and we're the loonies here, but
yeah,
we're making the connection.
But Josephus tells me by claiming that, well, it's not a claim, it's an assertion, that the name is pronounced with four vowels, that it has to be Yahweh.
Yeah, exactly. There's no doubt about that. Yeah, not in my mind anyway. It's very clear. We're talking about the etymology of these words, how these words change over time. And it's clear that in the early days of the Greeks and the Romans, they pronounced it very close to the Hebrew Yahweh.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, let's go into chapter 5 now. This is the book of the generations of Adam, and we're, of course we're talking about people that show blood in the face. And the day that God created man, that man, word man, I didn't look it up, but I assume it's translated also from the word Adam, in the likeness of God made he him. Okay, so he's saying what this verse is telling us is the word generations is derived from, I believe it's the Hebrew toledah, meaning line of descent, okay? It doesn't mean a bunch of people living around the same time. Okay.
Right. It's a line of descent.
It's a line of
descent. And there's a couple of things I'd like to say about that.
Yes.
Anyone who's persuaded that Genesis 2:7 represents some sort of eighth-day creation,
uh-huh.
they must admit that this is, therefore, a ninth-day creation.
Okay.
Because
right.
this is clearly another account of the creation of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to follow that line of twisted reasoning that Genesis 2:7 represents a different creation from Genesis 1:26 to 28, then the language used here insists on yet another creation.
Right, right.
And that's just the way it is.
Yes.
Now, this is the book. That word book means scroll.
Yes.
And it shows that this is a separate scroll. This is another telling, a separate telling of the story
okay.
from what preceded.
Right.
So we have one scroll or story existed in Genesis 1:1 to 2:3. Another scroll or story existed in Genesis 2:4 to the end of chapter 4.
Mm-hmm.
And this is yet another book or scroll of
right.
the genealogy of Adam.
Yeah.
So we have three separate stories that were concatenated,
yes.
meaning they were put together end to end.
Sure, sure.
And that's what goes on here. And they're each a telling of a different episode in the founding of our race.
Yes.
The first one being an overview of the entire creation. The second one being a narrower detail in written in parables, I would
yeah.
assert.
Specifically about a male, one male and one female, yes.
Absolutely, about Adam and Eve and the patriarch
yes.
and why we fell. And that's a parable representing a truth. It's not a
right.
historical detailed truth. I mean, every line in it is true.
Yes.
But we have to take it as representing something.
Yes.
And this is, now we're getting into the actual paternal line and the dawn of the history of the race. And,
right.
and we're going to proceed from the time of the fall of man and the growth of Seth.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah.
Mr. Comparé had a nice work done on that, and he says Adam was not the first man.
Yes.
And in that, he discussed this whole issue.
Right, and Bertrand did an excellent job of laying all that out, but there are so many fools in identity that try to make a different creation out of Genesis 1:26 to 27 and Genesis 2:7, and
well,
that's not the case.
The difference is that the word Adam doesn't even appear in number one, Genesis 1.
Well, yes,
and
it does.
It
appears in 26 and 27.
Oh,
the
man.
Of the dominion.
But
yes.
King James doesn't say Adam. It just says man.
Yes, right.
And
yeah.
that's true. We know that Adam is 120. But this is where the problem of 120 comes in. It should be one, either 220 or something different
well,
to separate.
I can pretty much... We've already covered this, and we've already demonstrated that the man in 1:26 and 1:27 was the same Adam as the man in 2:7.
Right.
And I would appreciate it if you went back and listened to the early Friday evening programs to hear the arguments
yes.
so that we don't have to rehash them for everybody else.
Right. And
okay.
Well, the interesting thing there to me in 1:26 and 1:27 is that the Adam, the Adamites, are the people given dominion. Whereas the non-Adamites that are discussed before those verses are not.
I'm familiar with Bertrand Comparé taught, and I have a lot of respect for Bertrand Comparé, and he did our cause our a great benefit. However, Yahweh did not create the other races. Yahweh did not create them. He created beasts, and some of those beasts were bipeds, but it's the fallen angels who went out and polluted Yahweh's creation,
mm-hmm.
and the other races are the result of that.
Right. Okay.
And I wouldn't make excuses for them and try to squeeze them into Genesis chapter 1:26, 28 creation, because Genesis chapter 1:26, 28 can be well demonstrated. That's the creation of our race, of
right.
Adam.
Yes. Okay. All right. And so let me reread verse 1 here. And I see most of Genesis 5 is a line of descent here. And we probably don't need to go through all of these individuals. We can probably just jump straight into Genesis chapter 6, which in which we meet some of those fallen angel creations that you just mentioned.
Yes, but yes. I think we should cover this lineage from Genesis 5:1 first.
Yeah, okay, well, I think I can turn it over to you if you've got the text in front of you. But here, let me just finish here. Let me reread verse 1. This is the book of this line of descent of, or the descendants of Adam. In the day that God created man, or the Adamites, in the likeness of God made he him. In other words, what we're being told is only Adamites were made in the likeness of God. The others weren't, okay? I think that's one of your points there, Bill, right? That you're
yes,
trying to
absolutely.
Make here? Yes, okay. Male and female he created them and blessed them, and he called their name Adam. Okay, there's that word Adam. And Pastor Dvari, the fact is that the King James translates the word man, the English word man, from various different Hebrew words. And that's a mistake because it causes a tremendous amount of confusion. For example, in Genesis 4:1, the word man is translated from Ish. It's not translated
that's
from
right.
Adam. Okay, from Adam.
That's right, I know that.
Yeah, but the average reader has no idea that that's the case, okay? And so you have to know these, you know, that these different words in English are translated from various different words in Hebrew, and in Hebrew they have very specific and often conflicting definitions, okay? And so let me continue here. Verse 3, and Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his own likeness. Okay, here we go. His own likeness after his image and called his name Seth. And I would just point out here from verse 3 that this description that Seth is born in the image and likeness of Adam, this is not true of Cain.
It cannot be.
Yes.
It cannot. Cain's not mentioned here. Adam's not mentioned in Cain's genealogy.
That's right.
And his special concern that Seth is in the image and likeness of Adam.
Exactly.
Which tells me that all those descendants of Cain that were just mentioned are rejected.
That they're not in the image and likeness of Adam.
Absolutely not.
If they were, the Bible would say so.
Right.
Well, yes. Adam was ruddy and rosy.
That's
and,
right.
And he and could show
touch.
Blood in the face. The others cannot.
Yeah. In fact, it reminds me, there was once a column, you know, Dear Abby. It might have been, you know, there were the two sisters that had their columns in separate newspapers, Dear Abby, and I forget which the other one was.
Ann Landers,
the exactly. They're Jewish sisters. And one of those sisters took a letter from somebody who had a problem with blushing all the time. And he said, what do I do about it, you know? And her response was, I don't know. I'm Jewish, and we don't blush.
Oh. They have no shame anyway.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. And I read that, and I was laughing for 3 days.
Giveaway.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to find that one and frame it.
That's right. Right. Okay, so then verse 4 and verse 5, all the rest of these continue with the genealogy of Adam. Through
now,
Eve.
There are two New Testament statements, and one of them is mistranslated in the King James.
Okay.
And 2 Peter 2:5 really says that Noah is the eighth preacher of righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the other statement is in Jude 14.
Okay.
Jude calls Enoch the seventh from Adam.
Adam, yeah.
And when you count on the surface, when you count the descendants of Adam down to Enoch and down to Noah, well, Jude and Peter apparently can't count.
Okay.
And they, my assertion would be that they certainly can count, and they are misunderstood.
Okay.
Jude says that Enoch is the seventh from Adam. He doesn't say the seventh what.
Okay.
He just says he's the seventh from Adam, which can't count Adam.
Okay. Right.
Because the second house from the corner doesn't count the house on the corner.
Right. Exactly.
Adam. Now, following Adam, we have Seth,
mm-hmm.
Enos, down father to son, Seth, Enos, Canaan, Mahalalel,
yes.
Jared, and Enoch. So Enoch is only the sixth from Adam.
Right.
However, knowing that Jude is probably counting the oldest males in the line down from Adam, and he's not leaving out either Cain or Abel.
Okay.
Now, if Cain is the chosen one here to make Enoch the seventh,
yes.
Well, that leaves out Abel. And why would we leave out Abel, who Cain slew?
Right. And
Seth
and
is a replacement for Abel,
that's
not
right.
for Cain.
Exactly.
So we can't leave out Abel.
Okay.
We have to leave out Cain.
Yes.
And this shows that Cain is not Adam's son. Otherwise, Enoch would be the eighth from Adam.
Right.
And why is Cain not counted if he's the oldest? He's
yes.
older than Abel.
Yes.
Simply because he's not Adam's son.
That's right.
And this helps prove it.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay.
Now,
yeah.
the statement
quit using
about,
logic, Bill. That's not good for religion.
Oh, yeah. It's not good for religion. Yeah. Well, Stephanie Jones would never, and I concatenate his two first names on purpose. Stephanie Jones would never buy this.
Yeah.
And would make a claim like that.
Neither would Ann Landers.
Right.
Or Esther Friedman, as Desmond points out. It's a real name.
Now, concerning Peter's statement, Peter calls Noah the eighth preacher of righteousness. The Greek proves that. And I noted the King James says that he saved the eight, Noah, a preacher of righteousness.
Yes.
But that's because that word is not eight. That word is eighth.
Okay.
It's not a cardinal number. It's an ordinal number. It has to have the TH on the end.
Yes.
That's the form of the Greek word. And there's a difference between cardinal and ordinal numbers.
Okay.
And they translated it eight, and it cannot be translated. It's like the difference between one and first.
Okay.
And they're...
So
we have a cardinal number and an ordinal number.
So what's your translation? How should it read?
Noah, the eighth preacher of righteousness.
Okay.
And
oh,
he
okay.
saved Noah, the eighth preacher of righteousness, is what the Greek says.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, for Noah to be the eighth preacher of righteousness, if we understand that in the tradition of our race, the oldest son is the family priest.
Right.
We discussed this back when we discussed on
yes. And Cain doesn't qualify.
And Melchizedek.
Yes.
Now we have Adam, we have Seth.
Yes.
Enos, Canaan, Mahalil, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. We
right.
have about 10 or 11 oldest males.
Mm-hmm.
And this is addressed and it's rectified in this manner. We have Adam is the first preacher of righteousness.
Okay.
Followed by Abel cannot be a preacher of righteousness. He's not an oldest male who outlived his father.
Right.
To
okay.
inherit the office.
Right.
Okay, so Abel is not counted here. It goes to Seth. It goes to Enos. It goes to Canaan. It goes to Mahalalel and to Jared. And it skips over Enoch. Because Enoch was taken out of the world by Yahweh before Jared died.
Yeah, so he couldn't have succeeded Jared.
Right.
Okay.
Then it goes to Methuselah, and then it skips Lamech to get to Noah.
Mm-hmm.
And it skips Lamech because Methuselah outlived his son Lamech by 5 years.
I see. Okay.
So Lamech is not counted as a preacher of righteousness.
Yes.
That makes Noah the eighth.
So is this the early stages of the priesthood of the order of Melchizedek? Is that
absolutely.
What
you, this okay. is the order of the priesthood of Melchizedek.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Okay. Very good. Excellent. I see we have Southern California on the line. Gary, you have a comment before we continue?
Yeah. On this Gary,
yes.
On the subject that you guys were going to about man, and you were going through all the things about man and where it came from.
Yes.
I would like to bring to the attention of everybody out there that it says all men were created equal. That's in our declaration, I think.
Yes, yes.
This country. Our early
what are you getting at, Gary?
So what I'm trying to say is our early forefathers knew what the word man meant.
Right, only meant
and
white men.
There was black, and they certainly weren't equal.
That's right.
So
well,
I
that's,
just
that's
I,
absolutely I, true, and I'm not going to dispute that.
Yeah.
However, if you read the writings of the Federalists and the Founding Fathers, you'll see that the full statement, the full expression of what was meant by the statement means all men are created equal in the eyes of the law.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And that
right.
is an Anglo-Saxon tradition, regardless of who that man
yeah.
had.
Yeah, and the Anglo-Saxons were all white men.
Well, yes, yeah. no, that's true. I'm not disputing that.
Uh-huh.
And Gary is right about the man thing. Man meant white men. It meant white society.
That's
and
right.
I actually have a Merriam-Webster's dictionary, and it has several definitions for man,
yes.
and it says capitalized white society.
Yes.
And I might make a scan of that now and put it on my website.
Yeah.
Well, the only reason that I brought that up is because you guys were talking about it, and I wanted to say that our early fathers in this land knew what you guys were talking about.
That's right.
And they didn't have to be retaught because they already knew it, number one. And number two, the people today say, well, see, here it says all men were created equal, and they're pointing to the black. No,
no.
He's not a man.
That's right. Not according to the definition of the Bible, and not according to the early founding fathers either.
Right. And the merchants and the Satans that rule the world, they've been trying to beat this idea out of us or into us, depending on which way you want to look at it, for a couple of hundred years now.
Well, they want to dethrone the chosen race.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's their point. And that's the motto of the French Revolution, liberté, égalité, fraternité.
Yeah.
And that's the dogma of the international globalists, and that's what they push here.
Yeah, I forget the name of the first black Supreme Court justice. Maybe one of you guys can think of his name.
Oh, he was...
Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah.
Thurgood Marshall. He even admitted that the Constitution and Declaration of Independence was for whites only. He even admitted that.
I've heard that more.
Yes. And he issued a statement condemning that fact. Okay. And so, but he understood the language.
Right. And,
yes.
And he's viewing it as an enemy.
That's
and
right.
He was an ultra-liberal.
He was basically a Jewish appointee.
Yes.
The blacks are, it appears like they're sort of like enemies of man because they're trying to take what we have.
Yes. The Jews are giving it to them, as they're giving it to the Latinos and others, trying to dethrone the white race. That's what they're trying to do. Yes, absolutely. Okay.
Praise the Lord when he comes back.
Yes. he's going to kick ass. Our enemies are going to get it, that's for sure.
Take names.
Yes, exactly. All right. Okay, Genesis chapter 6. Unless you have any more comments on Genesis 5, Bill.
No, I've said basically what I need to say.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to turn off the phone and listen to you guys on the thing. And
okay.
I just wanted to bring up that fact and see if Bill had anything to say about it. He enlightened it even more.
Right. Okay, all right, Gary, thank you.
Hey, God bless.
Okay, God bless. All right, so Genesis chapter 6, and here we definitely get into the fallen angel scenario. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth. We were talking about Adamites. And daughters were born unto them, okay? So the descendants of Adam and Eve, they prospered and flourished. Verse 2, and the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair. Now, let me just quickly point out two things. I know you want to comment on this, Bill.
Oh, at length.
Yes, that the daughters of men are the daughters of Adam, okay? And they were fair. And the word fair, if you look in your dictionary, in fact, my foot-thick dictionary here in my office, the very first definition of the word fair is to have white skin.
Yes.
That's the original meaning of the word fair. Okay. Your comments, Bill.
Well, I'm going to, I can't do better than my paper, The Problem with Genesis 6, 1 to 4, that's on my website, and quoting from that.
Yes.
And various theories have been developed around a text found in Genesis 6, 1 to 4. And it is quite often that discussions concerning these verses, like many others in the Bible, become emotionally charged because people have read them and they've made their minds up about them. And once that happens, it's hard to convince people what something actually means.
Yes.
This
yes.
is because people often tend to build their own personal belief systems upon a single biblical passage or perhaps a couple of passages, rather than upon the entire body of scripture accompanied with sound studies in language, archaeology, and history, which are truly necessary in order to obtain an honest understanding of scripture.
Yes. Certainly.
Upon examining this particular passage, it's quite obvious that it contains a conflict which is irresoluble. It cannot be resolved within the Masoretic text or the Septuagint alone,
mm-hmm.
when compared to other passages throughout both the Old and New Testaments. And that's because the children of Israel, that's the conflict here is that the word man here is Adam,
mm-hmm.
and the children of Adam, and they're the ones that were just listed in Genesis 5.
Right.
So it can't mean anything else in context. The chapter divisions are artificial.
Yes.
And this is a continuous story flow from the descendants of Seth and Adam right into Genesis 6:1.
Right.
This is the book of the genera- generations of Adam.
Yes.
And here they're getting screwed up already with interracial or interspatial, however you want to interpret this, sex and interracial marriage.
Yes.
And Adam is the son of God.
Yes.
So what would be the problem?
Mm-hmm.
There is no problem in that context. But evidently, we had to have a flood to try to clean this mess
up. Right. So there had to be a problem.
So there's definitely a problem.
Yes.
Now, and it's not only in Luke that Adam is the son of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's Deuteronomy 14:1. Ye are the children of Yahweh your God.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you'll basically be obedient. And,
okay.
And there's a lot of other similar scriptures in the Bible that
right.
shows that the children of Adam and the children of Israel are the children of Yahweh.
Yes, yes.
So we have an irresoluble conflict here.
Well, yeah, as translated, but I understand that verse 2, the sons of God is Ben Elohim, which is also some people call it the word Nephilim, okay?
Well, right, but that's not what it says.
Okay, what does it say?
Nephilim. It says Elohim.
Right, Ben Elohim, yes. Sons of Elohim, which is not necessarily Yahweh. Elohim can mean a lesser god. It can even mean evil gods.
Well, that is true. However, there are other indications that would be certain
okay.
in Hebrew in the cases and tenses of verses and
yes.
things like that
okay.
that would further indicate that
yeah.
if it were the fact.
Okay.
And I haven't studied every word of the Hebrew, but I haven't seen that argued anywhere, so
right.
I would say that I would have to give that great scrutiny before
yes.
accepting it on its surface.
Yeah, okay.
There is another way to resolve this.
Okay.
And that's to turn to the apocryphal literature.
All right.
And I can cite three sources for ancient texts that I can employ here in order to present a solution resolving this conflict.
Yes, okay.
And that's the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, which that's really one source, but it's split into two different portions,
mm-hmm.
and the Book of Enoch, 1 Enoch.
Okay.
All help resolve this.
Yes, okay.
Examining the Genesis Apocryphon, 1 Enoch, and fragments of Enoch literature among the Dead Sea Scrolls, along with other sources, both official and apocryphal, it is evident that there is a tradition concerning Genesis 6:1-4, which is contrary to the one that has been preserved here. And this tradition that we have in the King James Version of the Bible is the tradition that was preserved by the religious establishment at Jerusalem
mm-hmm.
and the later Masoretes.
Yes.
And
the Catholic Church,
with
too.
With all the mistakes that they've made over the
yes.
centuries, this can be called into question, too.
Yes.
We have to go to other ancient sources to attempt to resolve it.
Yeah, how did our ancestors view this situation differently from the Jews and Catholics of our day?
Right, they definitely viewed it differently.
Yes, okay.
Okay. First, there's another related tradition, and it may have grown from the text of Genesis 6:9, which has that Noah was born perfect in his generations.
Yes.
And this tradition probably grew out of that passage, if it's not an actual legitimate
mm-hmm.
historical event.
Okay.
When Noah was born, it very much upset his father Lamech. And because Noah was the whitest baby, was said to be the whitest baby that anyone ever saw.
Mm-hmm.
He was so white that he lit up the whole house like the sun, and the whole house was very bright.
Yes.
And I'm quoting from 1 Enoch chapter 106,
uh-huh.
and a fragment of the apocryphal book of Noah, okay, which is believed to have originally been a separate work, as Charles explained
okay.
in his translation on pages 46 to 47.
Yes.
And after some days, my son Methuselah took a wife for his son Lamech. Now, this is Enoch talking.
Yes.
And she became pregnant by him and bore a son. And his body was as white as snow and red as the blooming of a rose.
Mm-hmm.
The hair of his head and his long locks were as white as wool. Now, Charles notes that the term long locks is likely a corruption of the text.
Okay.
And his eyes were beautiful, and when he opened his eyes, he lighted up the whole house like the sun, and the house was very bright.
The Shekinah glory shone right through him.
Right. And his father Lamech was afraid of him and fled, and came to his father Methuselah,
yeah.
And he said, I have begotten a strange son, diverse
right.
from, and unlike man. He was so white, he was like, what's up with this?
Yeah,
and,
right.
And this tradition may have just grown out of that one verse that Noah was perfect in his generations.
Yeah.
And that gives us an idea of what they considered
yeah.
a perfect Adamic man.
Pure white, exactly.
Pure white, and so white they were scary.
Yes, right. Yeah, it's like an albino white that's so white.
Right.
In
now,
fact, let me just quickly interrupt you. I have seen, it's common among the Danes and some other Nordics who probably through interbreeding in cold climates, their skin is so white it's transparent. You can actually see through their skin and make out their, you know, their veins and muscles and stuff. It's almost spooky. That how transparent their skin can be. So, you know, but here you're saying he actually glowed.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Now, this concern of Lamech with the condition of his son Noah as portrayed by the writers of these apocryphal documents fully reflects what these early writers believed had been transpiring during the age of the antediluvian, meaning before the flood patriarchs.
Yes. Yes.
Now, from Enoch 1:6, from 1 Enoch chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. And it came to pass, when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters.
Yes.
And the angels, the children of heaven,
mm-hmm.
saw and lusted after them.
Yes.
And said to one another, come, let us choose wives from among the children of men and beget us children. So we see in 1 Enoch chapter 6 that this same story says the children of heaven, or the sons of heaven rather than the
right.
God.
Yes.
Okay. Now, from the Qumran scroll labeled 1QAP Gen AR or 1Q Genesis Apocryphon, column 2 from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the version I'm citing is by Florentino Martinez and Edward Tigkalar, and it's a very scholarly.
Yes.
Parallel column edition of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, it's not like Jewish stuff.
oh, right. It's impossible to avoid
yes.
at least having one Jew as an editor on
right, exactly.
the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah.
From the Qumran scroll labeled 1Q Genesis Apocryphon, column 2, we have these words attributed to Lamech. Behold, then, I thought in my heart that the conception was the work of the watchers and the pregnancy the holy ones,
mm-hmm.
and that it belonged to the Nephilim. And my heart within me was upset on account of this.
Ah.
In other words, the boy was so white, he thought that it was one of the mixed children.
Right, right.
And we see that that's
a fallen angel.
Going on
he thought it was
time.
A. He thought just like Eve, it was a child of a fallen angel.
Well, right.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, and he was worried about that, and he questioned his wife about that, and his wife basically, and you could get this paper off my website, his wife basically told him, no, you're nuts, you know better than that.
Yeah, well, one of Yahweh's chosen says he blames his wife.
Yeah, he did.
That's
he
what we
went
always
right
do.
To his wife.
Blame the wife.
Just like Adam blamed
that's
his wife.
That's right.
He went
she did it, not me.
He's portrayed as going directly to his wife and questioning her.
Yes.
And his wife replies, oh, my lord and brother, remember my sexual pleasure. I swear to you by the great holy one, by the king of the heavens, that this seed comes from you, that this pregnancy comes from you, and that the planting of this fruit comes from you.
Yes.
And she,
mm-hmm.
she's obviously...
And he slapped her upside the head and said, you're a liar.
Now, the fragments of the Book of Enoch that are found among the Dead Sea Scrolls
yes.
agree to a great extent with Charles's Book of Enoch, which was translated from an entirely different source.
Okay.
Ancient texts, which happened to be found and preserved in Ethiopia, which had been maintained there by the whatever you want to call them, priests there
mm-hmm.
for centuries.
Well, the Essenes, you know, were is how they're commonly perceived.
Yeah, and well, the Ethiopian church had a legitimate founding.
Yes.
However, it with race mixing, it became the corruption that all of that part of Africa is today.
Yeah, they preserved a lot of the Hebrew traditions, but obviously the church had become corrupt. Yeah, just like other churches.
Now,
yes.
Read the Dead Sea Scrolls. The offspring which resulted from the unions between what they call the sons of heaven and the children of men, they're called bastards.
Yes.
And in the scroll designated 4Q204, we see exterminate all the spirits of the bastards and the sons of the watchers, which seems to have been speaking prophetically. And that the word watchers is used of certain angels is evident from the biblical book of Daniel at 4:13, 4:17, and 4:23.
Okay.
With little doubt that it's not that it's used of angels.
Right.
A watcher and a holy one. The word also appears in a very similar context in a very unlikely place to the casual observer and to those unschooled in identity. In the Greek poet Hesiod, in his Works and Days. Now, Hesiod lived and wrote before Daniel.
Okay.
Lines 252 to 255, we see, "For upon the bounteous earth, Zeus has thrice 10,000 spirits, watchers of mortal men, and these keep watch on judgments and deeds of wrong as they roam, clothed in mist all over the earth." So we see that the ancient Greeks believed that there were a spirit being called watchers.
Yes.
The same thing that the Hebrews called them.
Exactly.
And that they were present here on the earth.
Well, now, we're being told here in very, very brief, terse language that that the sons of God, in verse 2, saw the daughters of men. Well, they must have been watching these daughters of men and lusting after them. And wouldn't this constitute their leaving their first estate, which would be in heaven?
Well, yes, it does.
Okay.
It absolutely does. And Jude is referring to this. And it seems that there was a mixing event that went on already in Genesis chapter 3, and that's without a doubt.
Yes.
However, these are also being considered angels which lost their first estate.
Right, absolutely.
And that's what Jude calls them, and I'm about to get to that.
Okay.
However, the version of events relating to Genesis 6, 1-4, which is being presented here, is not only contained in the Enochic and other apocryphal literature. In Brenton's edition of the Septuagint, a footnote at 6:3, Genesis 6:3, which is Genesis 6:4, the King James Version, is found at the phrase sons of God, which says that the Alexandrian manuscripts say angels of God here, not sons of God. Now, Brenton took the Septuagint from the Vaticanus manuscript, his edition of it, and we have an Alexandrian manuscript which has the statement angels of God, not sons of God, which shows that there was a different biblical textual tradition at one time.
Right.
Now, I'm not going to say that the Alexandrian manuscript is any better than the Vaticanus manuscript, but its weight has to be accepted as an equal witness.
Yeah,
and Hatch and Redpath's concordance support that reading in the Alexandrian edition. You know, they verify that it's there, the Hatch and Redpath concordance to the Septuagint.
Yes. Good.
Examining the Epistle of Jude found in our Bibles, it is readily evident that the apostle drew heavily from the Book of Enoch for this one short letter, and even quotes it directly.
Yes.
And to that, compare Jude 14 with 1 Enoch chapter 1 verse 9, which is a direct quote. And from those same sections of the book cited here are the sections that Jude quoted from, where he discusses the angels which kept not their first estate.
Right.
In Jude verse 6. For instance, in 1 Enoch 15, 1-3, it says this, "And he answered and said to me, and I heard his voice, Fear not, Enoch, thou righteous man and scribe of righteousness, approach hither and hear my voice, and say, Go and go, say to the watchers of heaven, who have sent thee to intercede for them. You should intercede for men and not men for you, wherefore you have left the high, holy, and eternal heaven, and lain with women, and defiled yourselves with the daughters of men, and taken to yourselves wives, and done like the children of earth, and begotten giants as your sons."
Yes.
Now, all of this shows that we can amend, and we have several sources for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
The Alexandrian version of the Septuagint, the books of Enoch, the Dead Sea Scrolls Enoch literature, the Dead Sea Scrolls Genesis Apocryphon, which is more like a retelling of the book of Genesis.
Yes.
We have all these witnesses that says that we can take this Masoretic text and change this from sons of God to sons of heaven.
Right.
That the sons of heaven came down and went into the daughters of Adam.
Right.
And when we do that, then all of the perceived conflict in that verse disappears.
Right. Right. Because the sons of God are not holy people as we commonly would understand the phrase. They're actually evil. They're the evil descendants of the fallen angels, or in this case, they are the fallen angels themselves.
Right. Well, that's why here they probably should be called the sons of heaven.
Yes.
And not the sons of God.
Right, right.
Because the children of Adam are the sons of God.
Mm-hmm.
And that clears up all the conflict.
Right, right. I mean, there are non-identity people who have translated this verse, and instead of sons of God, they leave it in the Hebrew, which is Ben Elohim. And the word Elohim in the Hebrew scriptures does not necessarily mean good guys.
Right, and they must have done that because they realized that there was a conflict.
Right, exactly, exactly. And, you know, in order to resolve the conflict, again, in my case, I simply go back to the Hebrew word, Elohim, and it does not necessarily mean the good spirits of heaven. It doesn't necessarily mean that. And obviously, if they were good spirits, they wouldn't have lusted after the daughters of men.
Well, that's absolutely true. But mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that all this apocryphal literature fully supports that.
Yes.
And it expounds on it and shows that there is no conflict in these verses.
Right, exactly.
There is a race-mixing episode going on here.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. All right, very good. Let me, since you mentioned up to verses 4, I only quoted verse 2 so far. Let me just read verses 3 and 4. And Yahweh said, "My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh. Yet his day shall be 120 years." So as at this point that the duration of the lifespan of Adamites.
That's the usual interpretation.
Okay. What do you?
However, the Septuagint here, it says, "And Yahweh said," well, "and the Lord God" in Greek, "and Yahweh said, my spirit shall certainly not remain among these men forever because they are flesh."
Uh-huh.
"But their day shall be 120 years.
Okay.
And I understand that quite often this is interpreted to say that a man, each individual man, is going to live for 120 years.
Right.
However, to the contrary, I interpret this verse to mean that this verse is saying that it will be 120 years from this time to the flood.
Okay. I see. Very good. Okay.
This is the prophecy that the flood's going to happen in 120 years.
I see. Okay. Also, the difference in the translation from the Septuagint and the KJV, which I just read, it says, "My spirit shall not strive with man." The Septuagint doesn't put it that way.
Right. It says that my spirit shall certainly not remain among these men forever.
Right, right. So the strive is an interpretation here.
Yes, and I checked the Greek of the Septuagint, and Brenton did a fair job on this verse.
Yes, and that's also a misleading statement here, because it makes it appear as though the problem is with man. Now, here we're being told that these fallen angels, now these women that they took as concubines, what choice would they have had? If some fallen angel appears in your living room or in your bedroom, succubus or incubus, whatever it's
those
called.
Those stories persisted all the way up. Well, if you listen to Art Bell, those stories are still around today.
Right.
There are still people that claim these things are going on.
What we're talking about here is rape.
Yes, that could very well be it. And that's what happens when a bunch of Negroes come into a white neighborhood and white men are apathetic and
yes.
They take their pick of the litter.
That's right.
And that's rape.
Yes.
And our people don't see it that way because we've been programmed by television to
accept it.
Yeah, to accept it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, verse 4. "There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that." Okay, that a lot of people ignore that little phrase there, "and also after that." that it was not just in those days, but after these days, when the sons of God, here again, the Ben Elohim, bear children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Of course, this word giant actually means powerful, okay? So it can mean, and here we're told it's men of renown. I believe it's true in both senses that these were giants in the sense they were tall in stature, physically tall in stature, but they were also powerful men in the sense of titans, you know, warlords, etc.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, the ancient Greek, and not only the ancient Greek, but the ancient Akkadian and Sumerian and Hittite literature abound in stories, and we have it in inscription after inscription, of giants.
Mm-hmm.
The Epic of Gilgamesh, which I quoted from to demonstrate that Genesis 3 was all about sex.
Yes.
The Epic of Gilgamesh is a story about a giant who is ruling over a city in Mesopotamia as its king.
Right.
And another giant, Enkidu, is who I introduced into Genesis 3 and when we related that.
Yes.
Enkidu was purposely created, I mean, this is what the ancient tale.
Yes.
By a goddess from heaven who came down and created Enkidu on purpose as an adversary for Gilgamesh.
Okay.
Now, that shows that such stories were around other branches of our race at a very early time.
Yes.
And it doesn't, to me, it doesn't disprove scripture. It reinforces it.
Sure.
Because it would be an odd thing if the other branches of our race did not have the same myths.
Right, right.
And I see that, in my own opinion, the Hebrew Bible is more or less the true version of the story.
Yes.
But just not given very completely. It's just a sketch. And the other branches of the race who didn't have the Bible but transmitted these things by word of mouth, expounded on the stories and made up sequels to them and things
right.
like that. Because
right.
in the ancient world, poetry was the primary source of entertainment.
Yes, right.
What about the giant of Goliath?
Yes.
Yes, there are many giants. And we're going to get into the Goliath story because Goliath, his brothers are called the Rephaim.
Mm-hmm.
And these
yeah.
the Rephaim in Genesis chapter 15, 19 to 21 are dwelling amongst the Canaanites.
Yes.
And later on, in by David's time, they're dwelling amongst the Philistines.
And the Rephaim are definitely fallen angels.
And the word Rephaim comes from the plural of the word Rapha,
mm-hmm.
which means giant.
Yes.
Rapha is one of the Nephilim. Rapha is the personal name of one of the fallen angels.
Right, right.
One of the fallen ones, which is what Nephilim means.
Yeah, well, that's why I accentuated the phrase in Genesis 6:4, and also after that, because it's very clear that these giants existed after the flood.
Yes.
There's no doubt about it.
The Greeks abound in tales of giants.
Yes, okay.
And giants mixing with people, and the giants that warred with Zeus, the titans that warred with the god.
Uh-huh.
And there are all kinds of variations on those Greek stories.
Right,
which
right.
show that they must have gotten them from their Hebrew ancestors.
Yes.
And later on, they expounded on
yeah.
them.
Now, let me just quickly interject here because some people hearing this may think that this all is all fairy tales. However, the archaeological record proves that there are numerous skeletons of giants dating back to these days. Because of the supposed, let me call it the fable of evolution, that they can't explain the existence of these giants, and therefore they are relegated to the subterranean level of the numerous museums around the world, and they're never discussed publicly. The fact is that there are numerous extant skeletons of giants abounding in museums around the world, okay? You have to ask to see them. They're not displayed on the top floor or on the first floor or any other floor. You have to ask to see them. And the fact is that there's numerous skeletons that have been displayed publicly. I'm familiar, you know, I'm reminded of at least one in England that was taken around on a railway car. When they stood the skeleton up, it was taller than the railway car that they kept it in when it was stood up. Okay, it was a mummified skeleton, all right? Numerous skeletons of giants have been unearthed, up to 20 feet tall, okay? These beings existed. They were real. They are historical. They are fact, okay?
There is a strain amongst the Jews.
I don't doubt
Jews.
It.
And we can talk about this. I can talk about this at length. I can show you pictures. I mean, I don't have them right now, but they're in my notes. And I have many boxes of notes from my monasterical seclusion that I just spent
right.
12 years
in the monastery.
Right. And I have pictures of Jewish giants.
Yeah, okay.
There's a strain of Jewish giants from the regions of Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan and all the way to Armenia.
Okay.
And southern Russia. And this strain of Jews, I mean, these Jews look like their normal dwarfish selves.
Right.
And every couple of generations, this race of Jews spits out a giant.
Right.
And they grow to like 8 feet tall, 9 feet tall, and their parents are 4 foot eight.
Yeah,
five
right.
5 foot two.
So recessive gene, yes.
And I have actual photographs from the 19th century, recent photographs,
uh-huh.
20th century, I mean, of 7 and 8 and 8.5 feet tall men that are just huge that look like Andre the Giant.
Right.
And if you never saw, I saw Andre the Giant in a bar in Jersey City in person.
Okay.
Back in the 80s, and this guy had a head about the size of two watermelons. It was huge. His hands. I'm a big guy. I'm 6'4 and 230.
Yeah.
And this guy made me feel like a midget.
Yes.
He is huge.
Okay. Yes.
And
yes.
It's incredible. And
right.
He's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And some
no doubt.
Of them are Jews, but some of them aren't Jews.
Yes.
But they're the same strain genetically, and he's one of them.
Well, that's proof that this genetic the genetic material of these giants still exists in the human genome.
Yes, it does. That, and a lot of these people, some of them have, actually do have 24 digits.
Oh, right. Okay.
And there's many known cases of these people with 24 digits.
Yes.
With six fingers and six toes on each hand.
Yeah, I wonder if they can count better because of that.
Well, quite often that six finger and six, they're misformed.
Yes.
But they do have them. They do have these genes survive to this day.
Yes.
We see it in a lot of the white Southeastern European basketball players.
Right,
that
right.
are 7 foot tall. They're from the same strain.
Right, right. And that's really that's the area where all this stuff took place, too.
Well, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's where the Hittites were pushed up into those regions. In
right.
Those mountains.
Right. And the Hittites were probably normal-sized Kenites, normal-sized Jews.
Right. They were actually dwarfish in stature.
Right.
For the
right.
most part. That's how they're portrayed in Assyrian inscriptions and Sumerian inscriptions.
Yes, yeah. And in the Sumerian inscriptions, I don't know if you've heard of, I'm trying to think of the name of the book. Sargon Magnificent by I can't think of the lady's name. She's
yeah,
not,
yeah. She made a serious error and confounded two Sargons, but
okay. But anyway, she has a photo of, or a sketch based on little figurines, okay, that date back to the Sumerian epoch. And those little figurines display very short people that have huge hook noses and
yes.
receding foreheads and huge eyes, et cetera, et cetera. And, she swears, well, these people were referred to as the blackheads in distinction to the Aryans and the Hebrews, who were obviously tall. Blonde, redheaded, brunette, what have you?
Blue eyes.
Yeah, and blue eyes and green eyes, etc. In total distinction to these blackheads.
Well, there are all kinds of, and yes, there are people that call themselves the Sumerians call themselves the blackheaded races.
Okay.
There are inscriptions from Mesopotamia and from Egypt which describe people with eyes like lapis lazuli, and lapis lazuli is blue.
Yes, yes, and that would be our people. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so So encapsulated in these few verses in Genesis chapter 6, there is a tremendous history of genetic experimentation, race mixing, and what have you. Isn't that what we're being told here?
Absolutely. And you know, Gilgamesh is even mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but it may have been a later edition because it's a famous story of a giant.
Right.
But it shows you that it's one culture talking about the same things.
Well, and now my understanding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's pretty evident to me that the Dead Sea Scrolls are very apocalyptic in nature. They very much verify the fallen angel scenario, Josephus refers to the Essenes of Qumran as being authentic Judahites, in distinction to the Sadducees, who were Hellenized Judahites, and the Pharisees, who were actually Edomites mixing with Judahites.
But there's no guarantee that the Sadducees were Judahites.
Right. Right. Okay.
In fact, if you look at the Book of Acts carefully, you'll see that the Sadducees were much stronger persecutors of the early Christian church than the Pharisees were.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
It was the Sadducees put the first James to death. And they were much stronger. Yes, it's attested to in Acts.
Yes.
You follow the Sadducees in the Book of Acts.
Yeah. So everything that's coming from Qumran, from the Essenes, it is our literature, in my opinion.
Well, I'm not so sure that the Dead Sea Scrolls are Essene.
Okay.
I call them the Qumran sect because there's no solid identification of the Dead Sea Scrolls with the Essenes.
All right.
But the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's a scroll called the War Scroll amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Okay.
And this sect saw themselves, they hated the Romans.
Right.
They called the Romans, even though the Romans, in truth, and these people didn't know it, but the Romans are Judah.
Right.
And or a part of Zara Judah is what they are.
Yes.
Along with the Illyrians and a couple other people.
Right.
But the Dead Sea, the Qumran sect absolutely hated the Romans. They called them the Empire of the Kittim, which is more or less a slur, and the Kittim are early inhabitants of Cyprus.
Right. They're calling them Hittites then.
Right, basically.
Yes.
That's what they called the Romans, and they absolutely hated them. And they thought that the end was, they were right on a precipice of it, and that the age would culminate in their war against the Romans, who they would prevail over at the hand of Yahweh.
Okay, but
and they would defeat the Romans and usher in the age of the reign of Yahweh. And of course, it didn't happen.
Yes. Well,
they were so heavily anti-Roman that I have to identify them with what Josephus calls the fourth sect amongst the Judeans.
Okay.
And Josephus describes this fourth sect as being very heavily anti-Roman.
Right.
And I think that fits very well with the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I would be more apt to identify them as the authors than the Essenes.
Okay.
The Essenes are very communistic in nature. If you look at Genesis, I'm sorry, at Acts chapters 2 and chapters 4, the Essene, and Josephus says the Essene shared all things in common, and whatever another man wanted, they gave him, and this and that. And the Dead Sea Scroll authors are not communistic.
Okay.
They're pretty much capitalists, and they're stashing loot all over Judea.
Right.
And that seems to be very un-Essene-like to me.
Right.
And you could get that from reading the Damascus document.
Right. Well, I understand the Essenes had different types of groups, not just the commune type. They actually had a lot of them forswore marriage, but some of them did marry. So it wasn't, you know, that isn't true of all of the groups. But in any case, the point I'm trying to make is that they had a very apocalyptic literature.
Yes, they did.
Which very much agrees with the Book of Enoch, which very much agrees with the Book of Revelation, that there would be an ultimate confrontation between the children of good and the children of evil, okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't think they properly identify the children of evil, even
though they
themselves, the Essenes, if they're to be identified, which I still hesitate to do, the Essenes were very much racist.
Absolutely. To an extent, their vision was accurate, because when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, it was it was practically genocide. That, you know, the Romans really did a number on Jerusalem. And
right, the Edomites deserved every bit of it.
Exactly.
I wish they'd gotten a few more of them. We'd have
them today. Right. And, of course, these Romans, as you pointed out, were actually descendants of Zerah-Judah. And so that the Roman general Titus, when he came in, he was actually an Israelite, actually fulfilling Genesis 3:15, wounding the head of the serpent.
Now, if you want to read atrocity stories,
okay,
in the Talmud, and I've seen the pericopes in question, and I don't remember where they are, but they're in the Talmud. It talks about 70 A.D. and the put down of that Roman rebellion and the destruction of Jerusalem.
Yeah,
and the Talmudists, and you can see they're doing the same thing today.
Yes.
In the wake of World War One and World War II.
Don't tell me they said 6 million even those days.
Well, no, they didn't say 6 million, but they actually tried to claim that the Romans killed like tens of thousands of school children in small villages.
Uh-huh.
And rivers of blood were running down to the sea.
Okay.
So thick that it picked up boulders and carried them down to the sea.
Okay.
And that's in the Talmud.
All right. Well, of course, it must be true if it's in the Talmud, right?
Of course. And we see the Jews doing the same thing with the Germans.
Exactly.
In the wake of the last two World Wars, not
yeah.
World War II.
Right, right. Yeah, and people don't realize that the 6 million figure was actually tossed out by Jewish authors during World War I.
Right, and when you read the Talmud and when you read the atrocity stories that people were still, it was before the Depression, and people were still, for the most part, too smart to believe them.
That's right.
After World War One,
yeah, right.
And the atrocity stories, the Jews are serial liars.
That's right.
They've tried to pull this Holocaust crap time and time again.
Exactly, for generations, for millennia.
And it wasn't until the age of television, radio, and professional sports that we were poisoned enough to fall for it.
Oy vey. The Jews are such a persecuted people. Of course, the chief persecutor must always pretend to be persecuted. That's how he gets away with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Torquemada was a Jew. I mean,
Yes, he was.
The Spanish Inquisition.
Yes, and so was Ignatius Loyola. He was a Jew, too. He founded what's that Catholic sect called now? I forget.
The Jesuits.
The Jesuits, exactly.
The Jesuits.
Yeah, that's right, the Jesuits. Exactly. So you can't understand the history of the Jews until you understand their secret societies, their enormous lies, and their distortions of history.
And until you pull the cover off all the Jews who were really wolves in sheep's clothing.
That's right. Absolutely. Like John Hagee.
Right.
Exactly.
Billy Graham.
Yes, there you go. And his name was Frank. His real name was Frank, not Graham. So, ladies and gentlemen, I see we're at the end of our 90 minutes. This has been a most entertaining session for us today. I think we just scratched the surface of Genesis chapter 6.
We'll have to start at Genesis 6:4 or Genesis 6:5.
Yeah, we left off at Genesis 6:4. So next show, let's continue with Genesis 6:5. And then, I think we can probably skip the Noah's flood scenario, and because we want to keep on tracing the bloodlines, the two separate bloodlines of the Adamites and the Kenites. Okay? So that's our main thesis here, and we're going to continue to do that. We'll finish Genesis chapter 6 next time and then get into Genesis chapter 10.
Absolutely.
Okay? All right. So I look forward to that next Friday night, ladies and gentlemen. This is Pastor Eli James for Bill Fink, and Pastor George Udvari has joined us today. It's been a great show. I think it's really amazing how much information is contained in these very, very few terse words in the book of Genesis in these early chapters. But it is indeed, it's a summary. It's a very brief summary setting up the rest of the Bible, which is the story of the children of Adam.
Absolutely.
And unless we understand that's what this Bible is about, it's who it is about. This is the book of the generations of Adam, the seed line, the descendants of Adam. Then you can't really understand it. And so, well, what we're trying to explain here, ladies and gentlemen, is that the Adamites have an enemy. And this enemy is documented throughout history, And we're trying to explain to you that this is what the Bible is trying to tell us, that we the Adamites, are being victimized, brutalized, genocided, and deceived and exploited by these Kenites who still exist today and are known as Jews.
And they finance a lot of people amongst our own number, like Stephen Jones and Ted Whelan, to convince us that we don't have an enemy.
That's right. That's right. So we need to keep pressing this message, folks. There is an enemy, and it's not just, you know, a two-legged enemy. There's a spiritual enemy here as well. And they take orders from that spiritual enemy, otherwise known as Satan or Azazel, Lucifer, whatever name you want to give it.
Powers and principalities.
Yes, yes.
And it's genetic and it's spiritual.
That's right. It's both. It's not just physical. It's both spiritual and physical.
Just like we are genetic and spiritual.
That's right. Absolutely right. Thank you, Bill. And yes, okay. So I look forward to next Friday night where we continue Genesis chapter 6. Ladies and gentlemen, Yahweh bless you all.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. And good night.
Are we off the air?
I just hit the end button. Okay.
I would like to get in touch with Bill.
Okay, sure.
I don't,